Joe, do you like to play games?
Yeah. Peter says you have the best games.
Well, I have a game in my house that you might like to play. Would you like that?
Yeah. Okay.
Welcome to this continuation of the Stephen King Night Shift retrospective series.
This will be the best ride of your life, Marty.
Join Garrett.
You did this!
Matt.
I am God here!
And Adam.
This is bullshit, a whole bunch of bullshit.
As they continue to dive into each movie adaptation from King's short story collection, Night Shift.
I am a man of my word.
Contained in this leg of the Stephen King retrospective are the adaptations of Graveyard Shift.
There ain't no way they're going to get this place settled in a week.
The three Mangler movies.
Like I told you, there's no free lunch, no siree, Bob.
And the two Lawnmower Man films.
This is also on you.
Keep checking in as the boys will continue going through each cinematic adaptation of the popular author's work, one movie at a time, in publication order.
How can you do this to me?
All coming up, courtesy of Percolated Media.
I'm in!
The Mangler, released March 3rd, 1995. Budget on this was $933,000. Yes, $933,000. Box office, $1.78 million. At least it beat its budget. And this is directed by returning to the airwaves of me and Matt's podcast, Mr. Toby Hooper. Seems like ages ago, you and I covered Texas Chainsaw Massacre with the one and only McDuffie. This is 20 years after that film. Toby Hooper's career is in a different spot, isn't it?
That's a fair statement, although you could say that about a lot of things at this time with 1995. Look at the horror genre versus what it was in the 70s.
Horror would be a year away from getting a much-needed upstart when Scream comes along. Matt and I have been toying with the idea of covering that series as well. But here we are. We are at The Mangler. Now, last week, we did Graveyard Shift, entering this leg of the Night Shift collection, this unending collection, which we're going to try to get through this year. Adam, you, my friend, you and I, this was the time we were seniors in high school. Actually, no, we were juniors in March of 95. You mentioned last week that this was kind of on your radar. You knew about this one.
Knew about it, and I heard about it. Looking back, I can't believe this film was made in 1995. I was like, wait, don't you mean 1985? So, maybe it's just because of the movies that I'd see. I mean, look at the movies that came out that year. Species. Mm. Lord of Illusions, which we saw together. Embrace of the Vampire, which I saw on repeat. 12 Monkeys. Doesn't it?
Yeah. It's amazing. That was 95?
Yeah, Tales from the Hood was 95.
What was my mind? Oh, no, sorry. Tales from the Hood. Leprechaun 3.
Leprechaun 3 was 95.
Yeah. Tales from the Hood is different. It wasn't Leprechaun. Tales from the Hood. Like that. Yeah. They built those together. But it blows my mind that this movie came out for under $1 million, half of which had to go to one person. At the same time that there were some decent horror movies that had actually come out. I mean, there was a new Halloween movie that year. It is weird that this, especially with the way this looks and everything else, you never could have told me this was 1995, and I would have believed it.
Yep, but we not only have the name Toby Hooper trying to get some asses in the seats, we also have the name Robert Englund, who, Matt, you and I covered years ago with the once again aforementioned McDuffie, Nightmare on Elm Street. By 95, he was 1 year removed from New Nightmare, and Robert Englund, I have met Englund a couple times at horror cons. He makes no bones about the fact that he takes movies just for the paycheck. And, you know, even though Toby Hooper was a good friend of his, this movie is something that I would not have imagined Robert Englund taking in 1995, although Freddy was over. Matt, why do you think he took this role?
As a personal favor to Toby Hooper, I'm sure that was the enticing decision, because as you mentioned, I'm sure he believed that he was done playing Freddy Krueger, with New Nightmare being sort of an epilogue outside of the original series. And I never thought, at least in my mind, Englund viewed himself as a movie star, because look, this is not an intensive production by any means. But outside of that, Stephen King, you can say what you want about the box office returns on the horror genre, but, you know, Shawshank Redemption was the year before, and that was nominated for Best Picture. And the Mangler screams when you read that plot synopsis, oh, the Academy voters will love this.
As I've mentioned, as we've gone through this series, Night Shift is a collection of stories. A couple of them King did write at the time of the book's release, but the majority of them were written before he was ever published, and this was one of those stories. This was a story he came up with when there was an accident, laundry folding place that he was working at, and he just kind of went home, did up this story. We'll talk about what he came up with as opposed to what Hooper puts in this film, but... All in all, with a couple small exceptions, this is pretty damn loyal to that story. Matt, did you read the story?
No, I have not. And I imagine King put something else into his system before he started putting pen to paper. This movie screams product of cocaine. I don't know if the short story reads that way, but I'm with Adam. If this was 1985, like the Maximum Overdrive era, this would be a great companion piece. You have to be on drugs to conceive of this plot. And yeah, like you read this plot synopsis, the one sentence on IMDb, that does not do justice to the context of this movie.
All right. Well, let's get into that much vaunted plot that Matt has brought up. So we open up, we're looking at a close-up of the title machine of this movie, as well as a foreman yelling at some workers, and Hooper is framing this like the boiler room in A Nightmare on Elm Street, with the red and green in the foreground, steam always on the soundtrack and in our faces. Matt, I got real Nightmare on Elm Street flashbacks here.
Well, I half expected to see little girls playing with jump rope.
Yes!
As we pan across this laundry factory. By the way, the Mangler should be top billed in the credits as playing itself the Mangler. And by the way, the Mangler itself is the best actor in this movie.
Oh, jeez. Now, Adam, you and I, we watched a few of those Nightmare on Elm Streets together. I'm thinking, you were also thinking of Nightmare on Elm Street at the beginning of this, weren't you?
Oh, you know what I'm thinking? Did we have a Graveyard Shift sequel that I was not aware of? Like, did they just make a lower-budget Graveyard Shift and redo it? Because that's what I was having a feeling about as this thing starts off. Yeah, I can see your point now that you mentioned it, you know, because of the boiler room and the steam and all that, and of course you're going to do it with Robert Englund. But all I'm thinking of, and I think about that throughout the course of this entire discussion, is, holy crap, all we did was remake Graveyard Shift with Robert Englund.
It might as well take place in the same goddamn town, and the Mangler might as well be the same manufacturer as whoever made those cotton presses in Graveyard Shift. Like, don't ever go to IKEA with Stephen King.
We then meet Sherry and Mrs. Frawling, as well as the new girl, Lin Su. So while tightening the belts so they can get the machine reloaded, Sherry cuts herself, and I thought we were done with Palpatine lightning. Because here comes that silver lightning coming down.
Half expected this machine to suddenly eke out,
feed me.
Let's start bitching already. All right, well, it's going to be one of those shows.
All right.
Was the Mangler previously owned by the vampires from Salem's Lot? Because it operates under vampire rules, apparently. As we will find out throughout this movie, like it might as well have Dracula's letter seal imprinted on it somewhere. Mm. And I am so sick of seeing this goddamn lightning effect.
Yes.
Like, it has permeated through several retrospectives we have done outside of Star Wars.
Mm-hmm.
It's like they borrowed it from every bad music video that was getting put out at this time.
Oh, yeah. We then meet Bill Gartley, played by a silver-haired, on a metal crutch, Robert Englund. So by this time, as I mentioned, he already played Freddy for the last time, at least he thought it was the last time, and him and Hooper were friends, so they got together for this movie. Englund took this part at Hooper's urging, and I'm not sure how well it comes off. This is a character mentioned in passing in the short story, but by expanding it like this and having Englund do this Freddy shtick in a film that already has a ridiculous premise, you're already asking way too much. And I was excited to see Englund in this, you know? I remember, I didn't even mention how I first watched this. I watched this, Adam, you remember, I worked at a video store, and one of the very first rentals I made was the rental of this film, and I took it home, and I watched it, and I was excited to see Englund in this. Man, get away from that Freddy shtick, especially underneath this old man makeup. It's ridiculous.
I will gladly take something this outlandish over the typical Stephen King archetype of boring, middle-aged, leading white man. We've had that with Sometimes They Come Back. We had that with Graveyard Shift. We really had that with Salem's Lot. So I will appreciate this out-of-place Robert Englund performance by comparison.
I am completely with Matt here. One of the saving graces is that Robert Englund, you know what? You might as well just turn him into a slab of bacon because he is hamming it up like nothing else. And if you're going to have a redeeming quality, let him be just over the top, goofy, silly, just ham hock his way through it. It is funny that with that old man makeup, he looks older in 1995 than he does today, 2024. And the metal crutch, it's just like they had to give him something, you know, to do some kind of affliction.
Well, instead of a metal glove which goes on your hand, he's got a crutch that goes on his leg.
Bites didn't come out of the thing.
Now, Matt, you said a few minutes ago that the Mangler machine has the best performance in this movie. Now you're complimenting Robert Englund's performance. So are you saying Robert Englund is better?
No.
Oh.
But two things can be true.
All right.
We had Freddy versus Jason. We might as well have the Mangler versus the Haunted Cotton Machine from the last movie. I mean, look, it paid to make Rogue One, so why not make...
Yeah. Gartley looks from above and tells them all to get back to work. And I really should treat my team like this when they get out of line.
Yeah, this is also the Stephen King trope. This is like the fourth movie of asshole industrialist manager.
Yes.
There's the guy from Graveyard Shift. There's Pat Hingle from Maximum Overdrive.
And it's not the last time he'll use it, too.
I don't know if you guys noticed this, but Stephen King tends to borrow from himself a lot.
He does.
No.
Englund says and is terrible for this film's accent, "Life's a bitch, and then you die."
Well, he is Freddy Krueger because he says he actively uses the word bitch like he does in the later Nightmare movies.
Yes.
We then see that blood has leaked inside the laundry machine. We cut to a sign that says Riker's Alley as we are introduced to Detective John Hutton, played by Buffalo Bill himself, Ted Levine. Let's talk about old James Gunn here. You know him right away because we hear him say, "Have a nice day," and recognize that unmistakable voice. He was 4 years removed from that career-making role in Silence of the Lambs. Was it just me, or should him and Englund have switched and play each other's roles? Levine is really just... he's the definition of sleepwalking through this role.
Yeah, and we're not talking about sleepwalkers for a couple of years.
No. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, Ted Levine reminds me a lot of Michael Wincott, where they both have very distinctive voices that kind of restrict them from taking certain kind of roles.
And you're saying this is one of those kinds he shouldn't have taken?
Yeah, I feel like he's miscast and is, for lack of a better word, kind of slumming it.
Yeah.
Which I understand it's kind of hard not to do that because this role is very atypical for these type of films. I mean, hell, for Stephen King alone. So it's not that surprising, but, I mean, there's other people like, you know, this is... it's the role like David Boreanaz should have played.
Oh, wow, there's a poll.
You know, the only thing I really know Ted Levine from is Silence of the Lambs, so it took me, for the first, 30 seconds, I'm like, huh, why do I recognize that voice? Then I'm like, no, there's no way. I'm like, what did they have to do to convince, of all people, Ted Levine and Robert Englund to be in this mangler of a film? It's a choice, but, you know, he decides he's not going to go anywhere with it, and he's going to mumble his way, through the rest of this next 90 minutes. It's a choice, but he goes through the rest of this film like he's answering the door to Jodie Foster.
Yeah, he's in a really good show called Monk with Tony Shalhoub.
Tony Shalhoub?
that I recommend. Yeah, he's really good on that show. But he's had a real distinctive career. There are roles like this, and I'm on that side here, where I just think he does not excel at. He is really good in Silence of the Lambs because of how creepy he is in that. You cannot be creepy and do this role. And here he is playing the protagonist, and he probably should have been the antagonist.
And you know what? I bet post-Silence is hard to get certain stuff because you get so pigeonholed and that kind of thing. So, and not to mention, Tobey Hooper comes to you and says, hey, we're going to do a Stephen King movie. I don't look down on anybody for being like, yeah, sure, let's go to town, let's have fun.
Well, he's also no stranger because he did Salem's Lot, too.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
One of the versions.
Yeah, he did the first version.
The first one, because now, you know, Salem's properties you have to distinguish.
So Hutton almost hits a delivery truck, and he isn't having it as he has them move the truck. And we see Mrs. Frawley, she drops some pills in the machine as the icebox falls on Hutton, who's already not having a very good day. And okay. These pills, they are a big part of the story. This is in the story. Go ahead, Matt.
Okay, this fucking town is full of klutzes. Between her and the guys earlier that were trying to move the icebox... I swear to God, the safety orientation videos were done by the Three Stooges.
These small towns. I've lived in a small town like this, and you know what? It's not far off from reality. We go back to the machine, and let's talk about this machine a bit. It looks like it was designed to look like a monster. The design of it is really outlined here. I don't know, for the centerpiece of the story, for a centerpiece that doesn't move, I guess it's kind of intimidating.
Sure. I mean, if you're going to have a production design, yeah, go for it, you know. But spend more time there then. Looks cool. I'm down.
Sherry continues to bleed through her gauze as Folly gets pulled in, and all Gartley can yell is, Hell's Bells, and God damn it.
Hell's Bells, like AC/DC from Maximum Overdrive.
Yep. Nice pull. Yep, that's a reference, yep. And my God, this is a lot of blood. There is a lot of blood in this movie. You can say a lot of things about this movie. You cannot say it's not violent.
Well, it's funny you say blood, because all I see are tons and tons of red paint.
Hutton stops at the Blue Ribbon and sees the aftermath of people crying and bleeding. And, you know, one thing I noticed here too, boys, is this is right in the midst of the run of the X-Files. You know, we were a few years in there. We have a lot of those X-Files coats roaming around here, starting with Hutton. You know, we got these FBI coats. Big thing back in the 90s.
Yeah, and it does the thing that McDuffie always talks about. Don't remind me of a superior product in your inferior movie.
Yes.
Actually, you know, David Duchovny probably could have played the cop character.
He could have, yeah.
I mean, it would have been typecasting around this time. But to your point about Ted Levine, I think also because Buffalo Bill is so controversial for a lot of, like, LGBT activist groups, it might have restricted the kind of roles his agent could get for him.
Yeah, I get that feeling, especially looking at his IMDb and seeing the roles that he took later, for sure. I talked about that when we talked about Jurassic Park and Laura Dern kind of getting pigeonholed after she was on Ellen. You know, it kind of feels like the same thing.
Yeah, and Ted Levine will be in a Jurassic World movie, ironically.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he's in the second one.
Oh, wow. A movie and I haven't seen since
the also in, you know, Shutter Island. He's been in plenty of movies we've talked about.
Mm-hmm. Photos are being taken, and this is where the story really starts. Picture Man takes a picture, and Hutton says that he hopes to get some copies as he throws up.
That camera in 1995 is older than Stephen King himself.
I think that's the camera that took the closing picture from The Shining.
Annette says that the machine makes her sick to her stomach, and offers Hutton the pills that Mrs. Frawley used to take. The local sheriff pulls up to say that they're there to settle a safety issue as what's left of Frawley's body gets taken out of the plant. They're looking at the machine, testing the safety bar, and they determine that Frawley's death was, of course, accidental.
Yep, Chief William is running the police department. All right, boys, yep, suicide.
Hutton's taking more pills as he says that he's been investigating for 15 years, and he's just trying to hang in there and get his 20-year retirement plan.
Same.
Yeah, right. He hears from his buddy, his brother-in-law, his...
Undefined
lover. This character is also in that story, and it's also not defined there either. This guy is the character, and Matt, my God, I thought of you while I watched this movie. Not just because I knew how much you were going to yell about it, but also the fact that you hate these characters that know everything.
Yes, I do. Considerably. I also hate for a writer who is often criticized of over-explaining shit, he doesn't explain the relations at all.
No.
And I'm like, also, of course this fucking small town has a demonologist in it. Must be a very popular trade school, apparently.
And let's be frank here. I mean, this was the time when studios were doing nothing but buying and selling Stephen King stories and making them into movies. This was a story in that popular collection of Night Shift. This was a story that he wrote when he was very, very young. He is not the writer that he would turn out to be in later years when he writes this story. He does not even think about defining this character while he's writing that story. I'm not making an excuse. I'm just saying this is a product of a different writer. And what a real screenwriter does is not just take that story and turn it into a movie that doesn't explain it. You actually come up with a backstory for this. And they don't do that here. And I'm not going to say it would have helped the movie, because this movie is, to preview my final review, it's beyond help. But, you know, at least you could have defined it a little bit more. So Mark tells him that the term mangle is being used to describe the ironing machine.
I can't believe it's actually called a mangle.
Yeah.
Jesus.
Hooper does a weird jump cut here as he focuses on a water wheel and then cuts to the mangler. Like, what's he trying to say here?
Well, Gregor Shift does the same thing, because it's water power that's like an old mill, if I remember correctly. Are they trying to set up, because I know a lot of King properties take place in the same universe, and they're trying to insinuate that here?
Some banter about whole wheat and organic yogurt finishes off this conversation.
Oh, God. I also like when King tries to make small talk.
Yes.
Because they talk about shit that nobody would actually converse about in this small town. Because this is not the kind of town that I think has a Whole Foods where you can actually buy organic yogurt.
But you know what? There are times when he is good at this. He's good at this in The Stand. You know, as long as that book is, you really get a feel for every single town that Virus goes through in that story. And you get a feel for those characters. We're getting nothing here. We're getting no feel for anybody. And that's what kind of hurts it to me. Because King is good at making us empathize with characters in certain stories. And we're not seeing that here. Again, younger writer. A hose gets loose and it scares the girls away. Garrity talks to the girl who made the mistake and has her run a bath as his neck growls, I guess. And Adam's smiling from ear to ear because he loves when England is just hamming up the screen.
At this point, I'm wondering if he's, you know, used that to stay, you know, is he hundreds of years old? Is he like a vampire? Is he like Count Orlok and that blood is transferred to him? Like, I'm wondering what his role in this entire thing is, but I'd rather have more of England than Ted Levine versus meeting up against the Wet Bandits and some of the other shit that's going on in this town.
Robert England Bathory?
It works.
There you go. She calls him over to keep her company, and he does this weird walk on the stilts and says that one thing worse than the devil within is the devil without. Hutton hears about the steam hose getting loose and goes to the hospital with Mark, who's roaming around again. Hutton sees Annette, and she says everything happened when Sherry cut her hand on the mangler. And she says that Garrity watches Sherry like a hawk, and it was like the machine tasted blood and liked it. So right now, we have a weird police procedural going on with this mangler machine in the background of it, and I don't know. I can't say I'm really liking it so far. This is a really campy premise, you know? I think there are some things to go with this, but I don't think Hooper knows exactly what tone he wants to set here.
No, he does not. I kind of think with a premise that is both this simple and also limited given the confines of a short story, they should have made this more like Maximum Overdrive, where it's just, you almost can't comprehend what you're watching. Because this movie also makes the cardinal mistake of when they actually explain what's happening, it feels like something from an entirely different property. Like, it doesn't feel cohesive with something as stupid as a haunted laundry press.
Adam, as somebody who's watching this, how are you feeling at this point? Are you going with this premise, or are you just kind of wishing it would decide on what it wants to be?
I feel like it's all over the place, but I also feel like it's a better done version of Graveyard Shift.
Oh, wow. And you liked Graveyard Shift.
I liked it enough, but the thing is, having Robert England take the place of the foreman, you know, for the most part, it's Robert England. So, you know, as somebody who not only watched all the Nightmare on Elm Street's New Nightmare being a fantastic addition, by the way, but I also watched, you know, all of Freddy's Nightmares and all that other stuff. So this is, I like seeing him be just batshit, bad B-movie horror crazy, and I can go with it for that part. what I don't like is that the rest of this movie, it, quote-unquote movie, just doesn't know what it is. Is it a B-movie, basement horror movie? Is it a police procedural? Or is it, I don't know, some occult magic movie, as we're about to find out? So that's where my issues are.
That's the big thing. It's playing itself off as a serious procedural with a premise that should warrant something like Cemetery Man.
Oh, God. Yeah, I remember that movie. Universal England was, it's not a great show, but remember when, Adam, remember when Wes Craven came up with Nightmare Cafe, that show that he did? Hmm? Like, back in the early, yeah, Wes Craven did a show called Nightmare Cafe with Robert Englund back in the early 90s. And it was only on for like maybe 6 or 7 episodes, but I remember really liking him in that too, where it was basically just a cafe that, you know, was haunted or something and Robert Englund was running it. And I kind of get that feeling from this performance that he did in that.
Oh, so it's the diner from Nightmare 4?
Pretty much. Mark invites Hutton over and says there's something really important he needs to show him. No, it's not a six-pack of beer. It's a book of dark magic. And then he asks Hutton if he ever considered that the Mangler machine was actually possessed.
Garrett, I thought we left The Exorcist.
I thought of that too. And by the way, this is from the book. Like, this character does do all this stuff in that book. And so this is the conclusion that King came up with as well. Oh, boy. So Hutton pushes that possibility off, saying that it's just bullshit. We see Gartley walk up as another girl almost gets sucked into the Mangler.
Like, I love how this movie operates like an 80s slasher movie where only women get harmed by this object.
Yes. It is very chauvinistic. Meanwhile, Hutton is reading about the Belladonna, the Hand of Glory, which involves the blood of a virgin springing it, and Hutton still isn't having any of this story.
Neither am I.
We are suddenly into magic, the occult, and virgins. Wow. We didn't just turn a page, we jumped to a different book.
We sure
did. Yeah, you're in a different section of the library right now.
Yeah. They head over to Sherry's, which is an ultra-nice house, and she accepts that Mark is just a student observer. They ask how she cut her hand, and Hutton thinks all that happened is that the icebox hit the safety bar, and Mark is the one who asks if she's a virgin before she kicks them out. Another scene from that book.
No tact with you, is there? I can't take you anywhere.
They then pull up to Mrs. Smith's house, and Hutton finds Barry on a stretcher as Mr. Photographer takes yet another picture.
This guy's makeup looks like Guy Pearce.
Yeah. Wonderful comparison. They see that this is the same icebox from the plant, and Mark calls it a transference of evil.
Okay, like 5 seconds before he says this, my note is, are they going to say there was transference to the icebox? As soon as Hank gets done writing it down, he uses that term, and I almost shut it off.
Oh, you would have missed the best part of the movie, which is coming up right now. Mark gets his hand caught in the icebox as Hutton takes a hammer to it. He knocks the top of it off as spirits are released with more palpitating lightning abound. Oh, boy.
God. The Lord of Illusion also style effects.
Yeah. This is bad. This is not in the story. I mean, I cannot imagine being Ted Levine on the set and having to act this out. Like, this is just ridiculous.
Kubi needs to call Spielberg.
Yeah, right.
The movie speaks for itself from this point on. I mean, I can offer subtle commentary, but the key word is disjointed.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I feel like they're literally transferring pages from different scripts to explain the machinations of the Mangler. And rather than making separate movies, they just combined them all and said, all right, we're gonna shove all this into one movie. And boy, is it convoluted. And it just, the movie's dumb. But not in, like, a fun kind of way, because I'm the guy who likes Maximum Overdrive, and I kind of wanted something like that, but I'm really not finding much enjoyment here, outside of Robert Englund and the prowess of this titular object.
When I see a scene like this, it just makes me think, Toby Hooper had such an weird career trajectory. And by this point, he had made Life Force, he had made Invaders from Mars, he had made Spontaneous Combustion. All of these movies did nothing at the box office, did not get his name out there. I mean, Life Force is liked for different reasons, I get, but...
We need those reasons in this movie, by the way.
You're not wrong. This is the product of a director who is... I don't know if he's trying to resurrect his career or if he's just trying to keep it going, but Hooper never got that same height that he did after Chainsaw Massacre. And I think Poltergeist, as successful as that movie was, is remembered not as a Hooper film, but as a Steven Spielberg film.
That's the dirty secret about Toby Hooper. And I'm going to say it. He lived off the reputation of Texas Chainsaw Massacre and never made anything remotely close. I get it. You make a landmark movie, you're automatically a master of horror. But I think we use that title very loosely with him in particular. I kind of view him in the same way as, now to a more drastic degree, but like Wes Craven. Mm-hmm. Wes Craven's got a couple iconic movies, Nightmare on Elm Street and Scream, both of which we've talked about. And Last House on the Left is iconic, but I don't like it. He made a lot of, the rest of his movies are crap. Toby Hooper is kind of the same way.
It was just sad. It's sad seeing him direct a scene like this, where he had that huge career. And at this point, John Carpenter's making The Mouth of Madness, which a lot of people look at as one of his best films. And
my hand.
And we're not seeing Toby Hooper make his best film here. The photographer thanks him for showing him his first ghost, and Hutton just tells him to fuck off. This is the point of no return for me. I was with this movie through all the procedural stuff, believe it or not. And while some of the movie was ridiculous, I was having a decent time with what was going on. But after this icebox scene, the movie just, it kind of lost me, and it never really gets me back until a very interesting way of ending it. Let's put it that way.
Well, I am the exact opposite of you.
Really?
Like, oh my God, they decided to go so stupid crazy that I'm at least going to have fun with how stupid and ridiculous and freaking 12 a.m. Tales from the Crypt type movie that I'm going to watch the rest of this.
I can't go with you because Tales from the Crypt was 30 minutes.
And that's the issue, yeah.
And it cut to the point. Like, there were a lot of Tales from the Crypt episodes about cops or detectives. You know, that was a trope, but they didn't spend a lot of time on the details of the case or the supernatural. They got to the interesting stuff. This really should have been like a section of creep, one of the Creepshow movies. Which they kind of did, because there's The Crate, which is kind of about object, and I think there's another one, like Old Chief Woodenhead.
Oh, yeah.
Yep. To do a Stephen King anthology, like just shorts, some like Trick or Treat with Stephen King that comes out every few years. Mm. He's got enough shorts, you could really do it.
Mark, the character who knows it all, talks about the exorcism of the icebox.
That
sentence.
Oh, goddamn.
Hutton then heads to the morgue with a very conveniently placed sign on the stairs to let us know where we are. He sees Mrs. Frawley again, and after Hutton kicks out the mortician for babbling, he grabs her pills, and I like this part of Levine just pulling the sheet over the body next to her. This is good stuff. Levine's trying to have a little bit of fun here.
That's like the equivalent of moving a crime scene.
Yeah, right?
like you move the outline and just redraw some stuff.
The photographer is still there, and Hutton says it's not him he doesn't like, it's his job. The photographer says they both share the same ghosts, and to forgive yourself is divine, and that he will have the photos ready by the night's end. Hutton goes back to the Blue Ribbon Factory and observes the laundry folding machine one more time. He then takes a couple more pills, and this is when the machine tries sucking him in. He shoots his way out and then makes his way to Gartley's office. Yes, he shot his way out of this machine that stays in one place.
I hate that you say Blue Ribbon Factory because I need a six-pack of Pabst to get through.
He's shooting the mangle machine.
I know.
And it works.
I mean, the only thing you could have is have that little thing open up and that you need this machine to say, like, no.
I'm just imagining Ted Levine. He's 4 years removed from working with Jonathan Demme in one of the most acclaimed movies of all time, and now he's having to pretend to shoot a fucking laundry folding machine.
Toby, I don't know if I could do this shit.
You can write Where's this, you sure can't say it.
Where's the cocaine table?
Gartley calls called, this is one of my favorite lines that England does. Gartley calls Hutton a regular Sherlock Holmes as Hutton requests he shut the machine down. Gartley laughs this off, very, very Freddy Krueger style, and then goes on about what real power is.
He should have put on the power glove like Freddy's dead.
Limited power.
He then says that there's a little bit of him in that machine and a little bit of the machine in him.
Raising. Boom.
There you go. Hutton storms out. Angry as all can be, as steam continues to rise. There's so much laughing on this podcast. I don't know if I can continue.
And there's two more of these fucking movies.
I know. Wait till we get to the corn movies. George tells Gartley that he agrees with Hutton and believes that the machine should be shut down, bringing up Gartley's daughter as he does so.
Gartley, we can't shut down this machine. It's the 4th of July.
Gartley calls the sheriff and says that he's having a problem with one of his workers. He then tells Lynn that there's a piece of her in the machine as well, so that makes her one of us, as he says. Hutton, meanwhile, goes back to Mark, who says that he's been studying Virgin's blood, because of course he has, and that this machine is definitely possessed. Sherry goes to the factory to quit her job as George gets caught in the machine. There you go, Matt. Not just girls get caught here. Here's the one of the foremen. He gets caught. And Gartley says that he'll do something all right. He'll dance. Which, this is Robert Englund, just, as you guys mentioned, just completely hamming it up here.
Yeah, I mean, you got dancing. Like, why not have Goodbye Horses playing?
There you go. They cut off George's arm to get him out. And this overhead shot of him on the mangler with his arm cut off is pretty gross. A lot of the red stuff here, as you mentioned, Matt.
A lot of the red stuff, not a lot of good thing or mangler. I mean, this is not. Ugh, of all the friends that you could have called in Hollywood, you had an effects artist that could have done a little bit better work here.
Yeah. Gartley just says, damn her. Damn her. Meanwhile, Hutton once again conveniently pulls up to the hospital just as the photographer is being wheeled in. He tells Hutton there's a present in his office that will help him exorcise the demon from the machine, just as he chokes to death.
He leaves Father Marin's phone number.
Yes. They go to his office as a small fire breaks out and he finds some pictures of his son. Hutton opens the so-called present and there's a book with a few of the girls who had gone missing from the plant, and Hutton repeats what Gartley told him, which is all of us need to make sacrifices. Hutton calls Sherry and tells her to stay in the house and that he'll explain everything when he gets there. He also finds out it's her 16th birthday. Meanwhile, Gartley walks into her house with a cake and Lynn's there to take her down as Gartley takes her out and he tells Lynn they better hurry, they don't have much time. God, England is in this movie a lot more than I remembered. I remember renting this movie way back when and thinking, God, Robert England's not in this enough. He's in it a lot here, isn't he, Adam?
He's in it more than I expected. Like, I thought we were going to, you know, maybe have him at the beginning of it, do the setup, and then show up again at the end. But, yeah, he's an important through line in this. He's in it not as much as Levine, and maybe not even as much as brother, partner, former, whatever that dude is. Yeah. But he's in it a lot. And that's a good thing. Like, I don't mind when he shows up. I thought I would. It is more cheesy than the effects on frickin' Freddy Krueger. But, damn, it's like, I could use the cheat. If you're going to be as bad as this movie is, and this is a bad movie, then at least I can relish in the cheesiness of it.
Wait till next week. Mark brings some holy water and a host as they get in the car and head to the machine. Meanwhile, Gartley and Lynn, they put Sherry on the machine and start their sacrifice. Hutton and Mark, they turn up and pull her out just in time.
Okay, Gartley, so we talked about Stephen King repeating himself. Mm-hmm. Once again, we have a town conspiracy that involves, like, you know, virgin sacrifices and ooga booga shit, as you call it. Like, I am checked out more than your local grocery store registrants on a Saturday afternoon.
Oh, wait, my favorite part's coming up. Don't be checked out yet.
If you pull out, she still gets to be a virgin, right?
Oh, my God.
Just don't release any steam like the machine does.
Gartley and Hutton get into it, as does Lynn and Mark. Because Mark's up against the female here. Mark is about to be put in the machine, but it's actually Lynn who gets into it. And Gartley just yells, "Trespassers!" They find Lynn's body as Hutton punches Gartley, and he gets stuck in the machine himself. Mark starts the exorcism as Gartley supposedly dies. Yes, they are about to do an exorcism on a laundry folding machine.
Yeah, Emily Rose, this is not.
Yeah, instead of holy water, it's bleach. The power of sanitation compels you.
This is a laundry press. It is a freaking folding machine.
The exorcism continues as Hutton sprinkles in holy water and everything else in the bag that he has at it. It stops working and Hutton starts celebrating before ingesting more of Frawley's pills, as does Mark. But when Mark realizes they're antacids, the machine blows up and turns into a 1995 CGI demon.
What the... It's going on.
This shit was straight out of the Lawnmower Man.
Lawnmower Man 2.
I love this so much. I love that it's chasing them down these stairs and around. This is
this is Graveyard Shift. This is that bat creature owl thing.
But you guys have already mentioned it. I think what really gets this movie into trouble, besides all of it, is the tone. They're taking this so fucking seriously when it is about a folding machine being a demon. And you have this fucking 1995 cheap ass under $1 million CGI and you're trying to make it into something threatening? That's the problem.
Been, you know, you ask like what director should have done this. This screams for Sam Raimi.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Or, you know what you could have done too? Just make Robert Englund have red eyes and have him be the demon that chases them around or something like that. Like, don't...
Or just have him be revealed to be Freddy Krueger and this is a nightmare on Elm Street Part 8.
There you go. Something.
Nightmare.
For some reason, they cannot find their way out as the demon stalks them and the door won't open. It cuts Mark in half as Hutton takes Sherry down some stairs. She starts yelling that it wants her and starts trying to sacrifice herself before they fall down into some water below. Hutton yells at the creature to leave her alone as it jumps down and pretty much extinguishes itself. And that's how this mangler dies, folks. They make their way out of the sewer and into the hospital. Hutton is told that Sherry is all right and then tells the doctor that he does mind if he says what happened to her. The doctor says that he can see her tomorrow as he raises his hand and we see that a finger is missing. He stops at the house and gets a letter from Picture Man saying there's a piece of the demon in everyone. He goes back to the plant as Sherry is now in charge and also missing a finger. Hutton sets the flowers down and drives away as credits roll on the mangler. What did Hutton think? He was going to get this 16, 17-year-old girl to be his? Why do you bring her flowers? To celebrate the fact that she's alive? We will never know, as this story will not pick up. Boys, what do we feel about the finale here?
I just think he wanted her to, you know, help move a couch into his van. I don't think somebody had to do it. I'm not better than that, but I should be at this point. Matt's better than that.
You're not.
You don't know me well enough.
This thing has more endings than Return of the King. It just, for some reason, keeps frickin', this is it? Oh, no, it's not. Okay, we're done. Oh, nope, we're not done yet. Like, it just doesn't know where to end. And for a movie that doesn't know where to start or where to continue, I guess that it doesn't know where to end. It's just as fitting.
Well, this movie's got more stingers than WCW in 1999. It's like they couldn't decide which one to end the movie on, so they put like three in.
You know, but leaving it open where, of course, somebody else is going to take over and she's a part of it and all like that. That seems completely apropos for the kind of movie that we were doing.
Yeah, and instead of with handing up from a book and the Crypt Keeper saying, "This is ridiculous."
All right, boys, that does it for 1995's The Mangler. Scale of 1 to 10, what do we give The Mangler? Adam, you go ahead and go, sir.
The bad movie. This is a bad movie. But you know what? In the way of Graveyard Shift being a bad movie, you can find some enjoyment here. And this thing goes so far off the rails, and maybe I was in a mind that just utter goofy schlock. It's nowhere near the worst of King's movies as much as we have trashed this thing for the last hour plus. What's amazing is that you got Ted Levine and Robert Englund and Toby Hooper tied to this film. And I think if you were to put on a poster today, just a black poster with Toby Hooper, Robert Englund, Ted Levine, well, you'd get a lot of surprised looks and trying to figure out what's going on, but people would be interested. But this thing is bad. and the fact that they're trying to make a horror movie out of a possessed fucking laundry folding machine. God damn. Somebody, you know what? We need a deep dive in Stephen King's psyche, because that boy is not, we know he's not well, but he was molested by some type of freaking industrial cleaning equipment when he was a child. It's bad. It's really bad. But you know what? Late at night, it is so freaking goofy, over the top, horrible that there's some enjoyment to be found if you want to. It's better than probably half the King movies we've watched so far, and I'm actually going to lay it right down the middle. I'm going to give this a 5 just because I enjoyed Robert Englund hamming it up. Once I understood what Levine was doing, I was okay with it. And just the absurdity of this thing turning into a classic 90s exorcism virgin blood type movie, like it's in an episode of Charmed, is ridiculous. So I'm going to give it a 5 on 10 because I didn't hate myself watching it. It's short, and yeah, it's, damn, it's ridiculous.
5 on 10 for the first of 3 Mangler films. Matt, what about you, sir?
So I've had an epiphany that I realized the Stephen King I respond to the least are the ones that play out like a bad series of Mad Libs, where it's real stream of consciousness, like cocaine speak, where it's, okay, haunted laundry machine. Okay, outlandish, but sure. It involves a town conspiracy that everyone's in on. Okay, fine. It involves the sacrifice of virginal daughters to the machine on their 16th birthday. Okay, fine. The mangler grows legs and chases them down the hallway. You've lost me. Like, this is sort of the formula for the stuff of his I like the least. But having said that, this is not the worst thing we've covered yet under his domain. Go listen to my teardown of the Shining miniseries, among a couple of others. Yeah, this is not something I responded to or particularly liked, but I'm not going to outright call it a waste of time because we recorded a fun show. So I'm going to split the difference and give it a GC 4 on 10.
4 on 10 from Matt. I've already mentioned my biggest issue with this movie. My biggest issue with this movie is its tone. I think if you had gone one way or the other here, you would have had a pretty fun hour and a half sit. What Toby Hooper and company and his writers decided to do with this is take it at face value and make it into a serious film. You cannot make a movie about a laundry folding machine into The Silence of the Lambs of 1995. It's not going to work. You have 1995 Toby Hooper directing this. It's not going to work. There are so many things working against this. Now, Toby Hooper would do things later that I do like. He did a couple episodes of Mick Garris's Masters of Horror series, which were pretty good. Like, he does have it in him to still be a good director. He did a remake of The Toolbox Murders, which I quite thoroughly enjoyed at the time I watched it. This is not an enjoyable watch. There are times when I think it can go one way, and I think, okay, if it keeps going this way, it's going to turn not good, but watchable. And it just does a complete U-turn and doesn't go where I hoped it would. As a short story, The Mangler it's an okay read. As an hour and a half movie, it's a pretty bad watch. I am completely with Matt here on one important thing. This belonged as a part of a Creepshow film, or at the very least, an episode of Tales from the Crypt. King has had stuff covered on those shows. If you look at Tales from the Dark Side, he had one called Word Processor from the Gods, which wasn't a bad watch. This is an hour and a half that is not very good, and I hate saying that because I root for everybody involved in this production. So I want to go with Matt here, although it's going to be a lower 4 on 10 than I've given in the past, because I'm not going to say I had hope for this, but in revisiting it, I was hoping that with everything I had bringing into this series, with me being the spearhead of doing this huge retrospective, that maybe we could get this series of 3 films off to a fun start. This is not a fun movie. The stuff at the end with the freaking mangler turning into a CGI monster, I could not stop laughing at. And I had a lot of time, I had a real fun time recording this podcast. There, as Matt said, there are things to enjoy in spurts. But it's not a thoroughly enjoyable watch, and there are videos on YouTube that outline every single quote-unquote fun thing about this movie. Don't go out of your way to watch it. It is a 4 on 10. But that makes one Mangler movie down, boys. We have 2 more to go before we're out of the Mangler. Next week, the only thing I remember about next week's film is a gentleman that I've had the privilege of almost working with a number of times, Mr. Lance Henriksen. Boys, what do we expect next week with the Mangler 2?
You know what? I'm going to quote Mr. T.
Hey.
I don't expect much. I really don't. It's hard to find the Mangler 2. I think this may be the first time that I gave the highest score on a King movie, and I get a feeling that this is going to be the highest score I've given in this trilogy of Mangler movies, just looking at cover art. I'm expecting more of a remake than a sequel, just because I don't know where you would possibly take this. But I like Lance Henriksen, but I bet this is just utter dreck. That's what I'm assuming. Dreck.
I don't take the presence of Lance Henriksen as an automatic endorsement of quality, so that's not something that's selling me, and I have no clue what to expect. All three of these have been blind watches, or will be blind watches, so I'll use my Jets allegory, expect the worst, hope the best.
I remember one thing, and one thing only about next week's movie, and anybody who watches it along with us and the two gentlemen on this podcast, you will know it as soon as it hits. But we will talk about that next week. Plus, we have The Lawnmower Man to go through, and then we have a number 12 Children of the Corn films to go through before we're out of the night shift and we're into a lot of his much more popular and successful works. But we just had a Children of the Corn movie released last year, so they are still making these things, and we're going to cover all of them hopefully by the end of the year, and then we'll get into some big King stuff. But until next week, when we review The Mangler 2, Sherry, you heard the boss. Keep podcasting. Thank you, gentlemen.
No one can have comprehension and attention at that speed. No one.
I did, Dr. Angelo. As a matter of fact, I think my retention is better at higher speed. Normal speed was only putting me to sleep.
That's impossible.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast, exclusively on Percolated Media.
Very funny. I'm laughing my ass off.
Join us next week for an entirely new review.
I've synergized a tremendous amount of data, and you and I have proven that most functions of the brain are simply lying dormant, waiting to be awakened.
And if you like this review, please head over to percolatedmedia.net or search your podcast streamer of choice, for we have individual reviews such as Knock at the Cabin, The Black Phone, Megan, as well as additional blockbuster franchises like the films of Martin Scorsese and Leonardo DiCaprio, the DC Extended Universe, Stephen King's ongoing collection, and many more.
I realize that nothing we've been doing is new.
And if you'd like to hear the boys talk about the film adaptations of Carrie and The Shining, please head over to www.bingemedia.net and click the Aftertaste tab.
No way to deal with these fuckers.
And if you would be so kind, please take a moment and give us a positive review and rating on your podcast platform of choice.
Looks like you made the list, Nardello.
It truly helps others find and discover our podcasts.
You need to be led, just like everyone else. It's a basic need.
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is produced by Garrett, Matt, Adam, and Nathan.
Clean up this, Warwick!
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is edited by Garrett.
I ain't one of them burning baby flashback fuck-ups you see Bruce Dern plans to quit your grinning.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is voice narrated by Adam.
better watch what you're saying.
I don't think so. I think from now on, you better watch what you're saying.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is for review and discussion, and all clips, music, and audio cues are used as such.
Now, do you have any idea what a VC rat eats? Try raw American whole mayo. Thank you.
Let's get Mangalus.
We back?
Yep.
Okay. Mangalus, huh?
Let's get Mangalus.
Oh, can I not wait for this discussion? All right.
Right, Mangler, right?
Yes.
Like, I hope. I didn't watch it for nothing.
Yep, that's the one.
It's Robert Englund. So, you know, as somebody who not only watched all the Nightmare on Elm Street's New Nightmare being a fantastic addition, by the way. Screw. Shut up, Garrett.
I'm with Garrett on that. So you're not covered here.
I'm alone on that island.
Yes.
I love New Nightmare.
Yeah, you would be to stay on that island.
But I also watch, you know.
Mark, the character who knows it all, talks about the exorcism of the icebox.
I can't believe you just said that.
Oh, goddamn.
Hunting yeah. Then head. Go ahead. Somebody was going to say something. I'm sorry. Hunting then heads. Sherry goes to the factory to quit her job as George gets caught in the machine. There you go, Matt. Not just girls get caught here. Here's the one of the foremen. He gets caught. And to get him, gets caught in the machine